Good morning, everybody, and welcome to our latest Tenneo Insights call. In late May of this year, the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis pricked the conscience of millions around the world. Video footage showed Mr. Floyd being restrained by police officers. One of them, Derek Chauvin, placed a knee on his neck. It stayed there for 8 minutes. The transcripts of body cam footage were sickening. They reveal Mr. Floyd said more than 20 times that he couldn't breathe. Before dying, he said, "You're going to kill me, man." What followed, despite COVID, were mass protests in many countries around the world. The killing of George Floyd forced a reassessment of whether we've come nearly as far as we thought we had in terms of racism, equality, diversity, and inclusion. But is that initial sense that something must be done actually resulting in the change that is so necessary? Today's Tenneo Insights call starts from a position that there's no debate. It is the responsibility of business to do more to improve diversity and inclusion. We are far more interested in asking how to help businesses ensure they do all they can, because the evidence is clear. Businesses that are diverse and inclusive do a lot better. And we couldn't have a better panel to help us achieve that aim. Ursula Burns was the first Black woman CEO of a major US company. More recently, she's been a senior advisor to Tenneo and a leading figure in the world of diversity and inclusion. Tanni Gray Thompson is one of the country's most successful athletes, winning 16 Paralympic medals, many of them gold. She now has too many roles to recount, but is here as a great advocate of rights for people with disabilities. June Sarpong is a TV presenter, world-leading diversity expert, and award-winning author of Diversity, 6 Degrees of Integration. She's also the BBC's first Director of Creative Diversity. And Matt Ford is, as I'm sure you all know, a very funny comedian who's currently the voice of President Trump and Boris Johnson on Spitting Image. He's just written a book, which is called Politically Homeless, which recounts his story being brought up on benefits by a single mother. And he's got a lot of thoughtful things to say about this. I'm going to start with you first, Ursula, because this all began, as we said, with George Floyd in the States. And you're currently in the middle of an election where that's also been a huge issue. How is that going? Is the initial fervor around this still there? Are businesses doing as much as they said they were going to do?
So thank you all for having me, by the way, far from America and American. I generally live in London, so I feel at home there. I think that what we find is that businesses have stepped up in a way that is in many ways unprecedented. They have engaged actively, they've lent their voice broadly to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And in ways that we've never seen before, they're stepping up and stepping out. And that's very, very encouraging. The problem with situations like this is that we have very short memories and we are extremely easily distracted by the next thing. And so what we have to do in America and around the world to make sure that diversity, equity, and inclusion becomes a movement and not just a moment is we have to keep our foot on people's necks to make sure that they don't let up, that they don't have space to breathe and allow bad practices to creep back in. George Floyd was not the beginning of this problem. It was just a flashlight that showed it very, very clearly. And we talk about, you know, well, George Floyd was killed, and this, we had 19 that we could count in the most recent future, a past, I'm sorry. We've had 19 African-American men in the United States killed by or injured severely by police. This one happened during a pandemic. This one happened during a time when people were just fundamentally unsettled. It happened when we have a political system that's not bringing people together, it's tearing them apart. And so it ignited people, just regular people in the street, to actually get out and lend their voice to the right state, to the place that people, where it should be, not where it is. And I believe that we will continue to make progress, because those voices are not going to be easily quieted. Businesses, surprisingly, as I said, have stepped up. They have engaged, starting at the very top, to assure that we get a more diverse board. That's being prodded by lots of people by African-American leaders, by workers in the workplace, by government officials, however it is, a more diverse workplace, not just African-Americans, but broad diversity and equity and inclusion. So businesses are stepping up at the boardroom level, particularly in the US, and we're very proud of this movement in a very short amount of time, but around the world as well, which is like I said, encouraging. Societies are picking up. Even if our federal government is not lending a positive hand, we see that state and local governments are. They are engaging broadly with social justice organizations, with businesses, with community leaders to assure that they can actually be a positive force. And as I said, the individuals are lending their voice as well. They are not only marching, they are writing, they are speaking publicly, they are contributing to organizations that try to focus on equity, diversity, and inclusion. So I see the start of something good. But as I said, you know, humans are like adolescents. We have a very short memory, and without continued focus, we will literally move on to the next thing. One of the things that we're doing in America as business leaders of color and gender diverse business women, business leaders, and all diversity, is to make sure that we do not, as I said, figuratively, let up the pressure, that we literally keep the pressure on, that we contribute to the solutions, et cetera. And there are solutions. And businesses, based on the state of government around the world, are one of the most important actors in this play. They are one of the most important solution providers here. And for a long time, businesses said, I don't have to do anything. That's for the governments to do. You know, they legislate this, they watch this, they police this, they set targets. We just have to kind of focus on the bottom line. We have to focus on our profitability. We have to focus on shareholder return. Thank goodness what has happened is that is no longer acceptable. That's the easiest job in the world. Just make a whole lot of money. The harder job is to make it the right way, to make it in a way where you include a lot more people, to make it a way where you can wake up every single morning and make sure that you're doing more to add than to take away. And that's what one of the things that a lot of work is being done on, a lot of help is being offered to companies by organizations, but by individuals as well, to have them understand that they have a role, and that we're not here to point fingers at you and say, you know, bad, 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 and look at how bad you're doing. It's different. We're pointing fingers at ourselves and saying we're here to help you. And so most of the business leaders are white men, business leaders around the world, not only in the UK. Join the club. Most of the business leaders are white men. By the way, even in Africa, most of the business leaders are white men. And we have to now, as white men, you have to be part of the solution. Raise your hand, ask for help, and start to implement things that you feel comfortable with, but you have to be affirmative. You have to be aggressive in those approaches to assure that we get diversity, equity, and inclusion. I'll stop there.
Ursula, that was great. Thank you. I saw lots of nodding heads as you were speaking then. I'm going to come to Stanley in a second, but first I just want to draw everybody's attention to the Q&A function, which is on the sidebar. Please put your questions in there, and in the second half of the call, we're going to put those to the panel. But Tanya, I'm going to come to you next, and I know you've got a lot of points to make, but I wonder if, before you do that, if you tell a story that you told me when we were preparing for this call about what happened when you were on the tube going to the House of Lords to vote. I think it'll help illuminate quite how big the problem still is.
So actually, next week, we're celebrating 25 years since the Disability Discrimination Act. And a lot of the questions I'm asked is what's changed, and some things have and some things haven't. But actually, it was last year I was going to Parliament and I was on the tube, and a member of staff told me that maybe I should travel at a different time when it was less busy because people had important jobs to go to. And it's like, yeah, I know it's busy, but I sit in Parliament and, you know, I'm actually going in. And then, being slightly flippant, I said, actually, I'm trying to go in to vote against the government to defeat them, to become a dictator of the UK. And they looked at me and went, oh, lovely. And it was this, oh, that's lovely, but travel when it's more quiet. And for me, people are shocked by that. But actually, for me, that's sort of a daily occurrence. When I was pregnant and I went for my first scan, actually, the first thing I was offered was a termination, because people like me shouldn't have children. And I was offered multiple terminations throughout the pregnancy, even up until virtually full term. by some people because, again, it was people like me shouldn't have children. So I've grown up in a world where discrimination, it's never normalised, but you have a level of resistance to it. And what I found in lockdown, that actually my ability to deal with that has just gone. And I think it's partly about turning 50 as well, where I'm just at a point where I am tired of being told to be patient. With the DDA, we were told on January the 1st this year that all trains in the UK would be step free. Nowhere near. And in January, I was told that I needed to be a little bit more patient and probably wait another 30 years. I might not be alive in 30 years' time. And I think some of the issues around disability just tend to be forgotten because we're not, like any other protected characteristic, we're not a homogenous group. We all have different needs and different ways of working. But unless, as Ursula said, people take responsibility and step and just think about what they do and take affirmative action, it's never going to change. Because where do we see disabled people in society? Well, we see them at the Paralympics. That is great. We see them when we're talking about benefit fraud. Or we see what the disability rights community call cripping up, where we see a whole pile of non-disabled people playing disabled peoples in films. And you're much more likely to win an Oscar if you crip up. So, you know, people are always quite keen to do that. So that lived experience of disability and the understanding of disability is quite often forgotten. And I think, again, another thing for me that happened recently where we call this crip washing, sticking me in a photo, whether it's sport or work or anything, doesn't mean that actually anything to do with that is inclusive. There has to be so much more behind it. And I actually have had conversations where people said, well, just sit in the photo and we'll discuss inclusion later. No, we'll discuss inclusion now and then I'll be happy to sit in the photo. And some of these things are a real challenge. So there's been massive opportunities through COVID. Disabled people have been asking for working from home for years. It's not been possible. Now, because lots of non-disabled people in quite high positions want it, it's happening. And there's a lot of positives with that in terms of how we can think differently about inclusion. But also a challenge at the start of lockdown, compulsory do not resuscitate orders were sent out to tens of thousands of disabled people with no underlying health conditions. But basically they were told if they got COVID, they wouldn't be treated. And yeah, there were and there are some very, very difficult decisions that will be taken about who should have or who deserves ventilation if they get COVID. But the fact that at the start of the pandemic, it was as a disabled person, you have no right and do not expect to even be admitted to hospital. You will die at home. You know, we are not even going to think about treating you. And the message that sends out is that disabled people have no value whatsoever. They might as well just be forgotten. So that's the sort of the challenge we're working within. There's no doubt increasing the number of disabled people in work is really hard. It's really, really hard because you've got to think about technology, about travel, about housing, things that actually are no responsibility of companies. But just for an example, in London, to live in an apartment block with a lift is £100,000 more. To live near an accessible tube station is £150,000 more to buy your house, flat, not even a house. So there's lots of things that we need to be having a discussion about, not just employment, but the wider impact of how this affects disabled people. The charity Scope recently published some research which just said a lot of non-disabled people are just frightened to talk to disabled people. And actually that's really useful to even have that conversation because it helps us think about how we break down those barriers. So it's never good to say to a disabled, but the only person I'll take it from is someone who's 95. But if someone comes up to me and says, so what's wrong with you? Not a great question to ask. Why are you a wheelchair user? Or can I talk to you about you being a wheelchair user? Is a really open question. And a lot of people I know are happy to have those discussions. But actually, it's about people like me and lots of other people just standing up and saying what the issues are, because if we're not able to openly discuss the issues, we can't change them. Do I think we're at open door? We're at a more open door than we've ever had before. But again, as Ursula said, we've got to keep pushing. We can't let the opportunities of where we are now slip back, because otherwise it would be too easy not to think about how we look at intersectionality and how we actually give opportunities to far more people than we're currently giving. Thank you.
Tony, thank you. That was incredibly powerful. Lots of questions starting to come through, but I'm going to come to June next. June, among all the many things you've been doing around diversity, you're currently the Director of Creative Diversity at the BBC, and that's our leading cultural institution. I used to work there, so I know you've got your work cut out. Tell us about how you're achieving it and how it's working there.
Yeah, of course. I think before I touch on that, I'd like to just touch on allyship a bit first, because I think particularly with this audience, it's really important, and actually it feeds into some of what Ursula was saying. I think part of the reason why the George Floyd killing impacted us the way it did is, as Ursula was saying, because we were in COVID, we were all in sort of a self-reflection mode and much more introspective, but also because we knew if George Floyd had been somebody else, he probably would still be alive today. Had he been one of the people on this call listening into this session, he probably would have been alive. And the thing is, it then means that those with more agency in society had to start asking themselves questions around white privilege and actually what that means in reality. And I think that what we have now is we are at a place where the customer, the audience, society themselves are demanding it, so we can't turn away. And that's no different for the BBC, because for us, we are the mirror of the UK to ourselves and the rest of the world. And what was interesting for us when everything happened with the George Floyd killing was, in a way, we were already dealing with many of these issues, particularly around race, because of what had happened 6 months earlier with the Nagamunchetti episode, where, of course, there was a ruling that many people in the public disagreed with and much of our staff disagreed with. And there was a lot of conversations being had internally around race and representation. I think that the role of allies is absolutely crucial, because often when you are a leader, you are the person that everybody comes to for the last word on an issue. And it's rare to have an issue that perhaps you don't know about. And when it comes to the issue of race and injustice and inequality, and even with what Tani was talking about with disability, as we know, society isn't equal. We don't have a level playing field, and most of the people in positions of power are able-bodied, cisgender, white men. And so what we now have to have is a place where those men, those people in the position of power, realize that they actually must be a part of the solution and have to be actively anti-racist in that. So what we're doing at the BBC is a number of things. So with all of our leadership committees, so when I joined, as I said, there was a lot of tension around the NAGA issue. And so we needed a quick win. We needed a quick win in order to buy us time to do the long-term stuff. So what I suggested was, looking around all of our leadership groups, we were nowhere near hitting our targets on whether that was on race or disability, and certainly not on social economic diversity. And so the issue then was, well, what can we do about it? And was there even enough of a pipeline to then be able to find the next level of talent to pull from? We didn't have it. So what we decided was that every leadership committee in the organization would have at least two diverse advisors, and we would find talent within that were ready to step up into positions of leadership and support them through that process. Also, it would mean that our leaders would then know who was there and who needed to be developed. So now every leadership committee has at least two diverse advisors. We now have another pool of talent who applied for that didn't get the positions that we can still train. And the idea being, within 2 years, we have enough talent there to be able to assume these roles on a permanent basis. The other thing which I think is really key, and which we're doing with our leadership, is outside the box training, where the majority become the minority. When you are a privileged white man, it's very rare you're in a position where you're the only one in the room. It's very rare where you're in a position where you feel like the other. And so it's about putting those people in uncomfortable positions. So we're doing a set of training where we take them into environments where they are the minority, so they can understand what that feels like. And then in terms of what we're doing long term, we've just announced £100 million investment in diverse content and in diverse storytellers. We are making sure that a key focus of that is on actually diverse owned production companies, not just the creatives. And then on top of that, 20% of all of our talent behind the camera will now have to come from underrepresented groups. I think with this stuff, you have to act. We're beyond the point of empty rhetoric. You have to act. And then you have to constantly measure and monitor to see if you are being successful. And then if it's not working, modify whatever you're doing and come up with something new. But we're at a point where actually the customer won't stand for it anymore. And then it's also about your personal legacy. As Ursula said, making lots of money, for those of you that are at the top of your game, that's the easy bit. It's now about what kind of legacy do you want to leave? And I think particularly on race, and actually I'm sure Tanya agrees with me on disability as well, there aren't many companies getting it right. And the leader that does get it right on these issues, that's who everybody will want to emulate.
June, thank you. That was great. Matt, as I've got to know you, you're not just a funny comedian. I know that you're incredibly thoughtful on all of this. And I just wondered if you'd like to give us your thoughts and experiences before we go to the Q&A section. You're on mute, Matt.
Thank you very much. Able-bodied, cisgendered, straight white male, I realise that my experience is nowhere near the sort of experience that Ursula and June and Tanny have had. So I'm not trying to suggest that class disadvantage, the sort that I experienced, is anywhere near the sort of severe experience that other people have experienced. So as long as you appreciate that I deliver this message with a certain amount of white guilt and, you know, then we're all fine. I do feel a bit like Bernard Matthews at a vegetarian conference, but I shall soldier on and make the point about class, which is really important. I grew up on in a single parent family on benefits in inner city Nottingham in the 1980s and 1990s. And the effect that that has on people from that sort of background is really profound. Firstly, God bless Marcus Rashford, because I received free school meals every year that I had to go to school. And thankfully, the system has changed. But when I was at school, which wasn't that long ago, I had to queue up in a separate line and get a token. And any admin error meant that I didn't get a dinner that day. I had to borrow money. You know, it was a gut-wrenching experience. And the mixture of gratitude and embarrassment at getting that free school meal is something that I've never shaken off. And the long-term effect of coming from that sort of background. And this isn't just about white working class people, of course. And I appreciate that as a white working class person, as someone who was effectively a member of the underclass, being part of the benefit class, was that people from ethnic minorities were obviously having that struggle and other struggles as well. So this doesn't just apply to white working class people, of course. But the effect of that is that it hugely limits your horizons. And I don't think you should ever forget that when you're dealing with people from backgrounds like mine or similar to mine, it never even occurred to me that I could do anything with my life. I had a really good mum who gave me a lot of discipline and love and thought. And you know, it's credit to her that I've ended up doing anything with my life. But it didn't even occur to me that I would move out of my area of Nottingham, let alone ever move to London. And when I consider the contrast in the experience of friends of mine who are privately educated or financially privileged, these are people who, done with the right reasons, are told that they're good and that they're clever and they can do anything with their lives. So from a business perspective, when you're interviewing people that are sat side by side, you know, you're interviewing people from backgrounds like mine, one thing I would say is never misinterpret modesty or shyness as a product of that upbringing as a lack of talent or ability. And you're judging them next to people who've always been told they're great, who have told that actually huge achievements are eminently reasonable and indeed expected. Of course, those people are going to present better in interview scenarios. So, and I think one of the main advantages that private education and financial privilege gives people, apart from firstly higher educational attainment that opens up doors, the sense of being part of an elite club and being perhaps a little bit better than other people, and I appreciate not everyone feels like that, but from the outside it can sometimes feel like that, is the confidence that financial privilege and particularly a private education gives people is really marked. And I notice it. I worked in politics for a while and I notice it in friends, is I doubt myself more as a result of, you know, it's really hard to forget that I had to queue up for dinner tokens and was worse off and all the things. It's really hard to forget that at a point in my life, I never thought that I could do things. And that takes years for people. Some people never get over that. So what I would say from a practical point of view for businesses is don't misinterpret confidence for ability. And equally on the other side, recruit people from different backgrounds, take risks on people, and they may present as slightly more self-doubting, but don't misinterpret that as not actually knowing what they're talking about, because it can be really intimidating, particularly in business and in elite pursuits, things like politics and law and finance. I mean, I still would have no idea how to get a job in finance at all. It's a world that just doesn't feel open to me, however far I travel in life. I think the point I would make about that is that if you come from a background like mine, those places just don't feel open to you. And the confidence that people have moving in those circles is something that I never really fully felt. And that confidence, that the side effect of that confidence is that it can make people who aren't from that walk of life doubt themselves. Think, well, they really sound like they know what they're on about, so they must know it. Whereas actually I may know more than them, but I don't have that confidence that in a way that breeding and that background gives you. So I would say recruit people from different backgrounds. Look elsewhere for wherever you advertise. Think about different places that you could advertise for jobs. Cast the net a bit wider and be prepared to take people on that may need a bit of coaching, because the benefit of that is you have more perspectives in your company that gives you, it helps stop groupthink. It gives you a wider perspective, which the logic would follow, that you would understand your marketplace and your customers a lot better. And one thing I would really say is that people from disadvantaged backgrounds that even get to an interview stage or even dare apply for jobs in businesses like yours have already had to overcome so much adversity. They've had to do so much themselves that they possess so many abilities that employers should really value. On top of, I think that they're used to dealing with adversity, which, given the year that we've had, you need people in your organisations that know how to deal with a crisis. These are people that have often had to go without food. They know what a real crisis looks like. Dealing with crises in the business world or in the organisational world will be nothing compared to what they've already had to do. So in short, cast the net wider, recruit from people with different accents and different backgrounds. Not only do you do social good, but it is in your long-term economic interest.
Thanks for that, Matt. Loads of questions are coming through. But before I go to all of that, I just want to start with probably the most difficult issue for a lot of people. Many people who are watching this call are like me. You know, they're white, they're middle class, male. They're a bit nervous about talking about some of these things, worried that they're going to get things wrong. And some of the comments that are coming through about, like, what would you say to those people? What are the things that they need to do when they're particularly worried or nervous or thinking that they're tripping up or maybe aren't conscious of some of the biases that they may have. So I'm going to put that to all of you first, but Ursula, let's start with you.
Well, I say, first of all, get over it. Believe it or not, the world is fairly forgiving. Particularly people who need help themselves understand when other people need help, and diverse people, socioeconomically different people, different ability people, all have started with the same position. So they've been in your space where they don't feel comfortable. They, as June said, they are the guys who are asking for help or feeling put out. So I say, first of all, get over it, and like you do everything, start by trying. Second is, stay close to home. Start close to home before we start to tackle these massive issues of societal disparities. How about fixing it in your workplace? How about working on it in your communities? And don't look far to anywhere else to fix it. Start doing some things close to home. And when I mean home, I mean your workplace. Particularly if you're business leaders, you can do this without a lot of fanfare, without a lot of money. And so that's the second. The third is ask for help. There are people who do this. June, Tanny, Matt, Craig, Taneo. There are people who do this and who can help you. We're not perfect, by the way. We have our own problems. So the brown and black people of the world don't understand it. The less able people of the world, differently able people, and so on and so on. We don't understand the white men who grew up in, but we all, if we come together, we can actually probably make a difference here. So I say, literally, get people around you who are different, who you can learn from. Start close to home. And last, you have to be affirmative here. This is not going to happen by gravity. This is, we're not going to say, okay, all we got to do is go to schools and train some more of these guys, and eventually they'll all be. No, this, you have to make active decisions that are affirmative, and many people would argue discriminatory to the incumbent. And I say that this is the, you don't want to start me on this one. This is the biggest piece of BS that I've ever heard in my life. But it's an argument that is had every day. Literally, you can't have a meritocracy if the people who are in this meritocracy don't have the even playing field. We don't have that today. So you have to be affirmative. You have to look, Matt said it, you have to look outside your, outside of your circle. You have to make accommodations. Absolutely have to do it. You have to absolutely break glass to actually change the status quo. So you have to be affirmative.
Thank you. So I want to tackle that a bit in a moment, because I think that is a really big issue about you know, how affirmative you should be. But Tanny, I thought listening to you, what was so difficult is like your achievement, you know, in the sporting world, you know, in politics, in so many other areas is huge. But what you're saying is that quite often people just look at you and assume you are less. How do you help people understand that and get over that and realize that there's a lot to be gained by having people like you in their organization?
It's interesting because people don't look at my face, they look at the wheelchair, and I'm treated three very distinct ways. Once as a Paralympian, which is generally all lovely, once as a parliamentarian where people either love you or hate you and not much in between, and then the third way is a disabled woman. And what's interesting, my daughter's just turned 18, and in the last 6 months, people now talk to her, not me. So they'll come up to her and go, is she okay? And Karis usually is like, well, I've no idea who she is, she's just following me. So the impact of how I'm treated is much, much wider in terms of how it impacts people around me. And what Matt was saying, actually, when I was in my 20s, I was told I'd never get a job in TV because I had a dreadful colloquial Welsh accent. And luckily, some of that has changed. Not all of it, but some of that's changed. But I think people at the highest level, they have to have this bravado and they have to be... think they're the expert on everything, and they don't like asking for help, and they don't like to be seen to be asking for help, so they have to get over it and also have conversations, and quite difficult conversations with people about that kind of lived experience. What I would say don't ever do is don't borrow someone's wheelchair and push around in it for half a day and think you have any idea of what it's like to be a wheelchair user, because surprisingly your office is not a setup to be a wheelchair user, surprisingly, because you've never pushed a wheelchair in your life, your arms hurt. You know, surprisingly, you can't carry a cup of coffee because you've never done it before. So, you know, it's stuff like that. And it's still being used a bit. It is absolute nonsense. So, you know, actually go out and find, go and find people to talk to and, you know, ask for help, because there are lots and lots of people who want to help. Some people may not want to, or might not find it easy to talk about some of their lived experience because about it's sort of reliving it and challenges, but it's not as if you can't find people to go and talk about these things to make a difference. So there is no excuse. The final thing was, if I have one more person who comes up to me and says, oh, I know what it's like for you because I broke my ankle and I spent 6 weeks in a wheelchair, I think I'm again slightly over smiling and going, yeah, I'm just going to go, no, you don't, you know. So it's don't assume what you think someone's lived experience is. Because actually, my life is not true. So the other one, someone recently said to me, if I was like you, I'd have killed myself. Thanks. Yep. Yeah. Actually, my life is all right. But that says more about you than it says about me. So, you know, talk to people and get help. Just don't be complacent and don't think you're an expert in everything.
June, a lot of education then.
Yeah.
So you're on YouTube. Are you back on?
Yes, 100%, which I would highly recommend, not that I'm plugging, but it answers many of these questions. My new book, which is Power of Privilege, How White People Can Challenge Racism. And I think it's really important that actually for those who are uncomfortable and who don't want to say the wrong thing, maybe you don't have to say anything. Maybe you actually need to just listen. And I think be open to getting it wrong and be confident enough, as Ursula was saying, in terms of getting over it, about getting it wrong. There are many other things you get it right on in terms of the bottom line and EBITDA and goodness knows what else. That's why you are the CEO. But on this one, you haven't done it for whatever reason. So this is new territory. So what I would say is listen. And often what happens when those from the majority group are challenged on this issue, there's the need to go into defensive mode and to defend and to say, oh no, of course it isn't that way. How would you know? How could you possibly know? And I think it's about sort of stepping back and allowing people to truly speak their lived experience to you and to offer you solutions about how the culture can be improved within your organization. And then for yourself as a leader, decide you are going to make this one of your key areas of focus for the business. And in the same way, you're very focused and targeted on growing whatever division or whatever department or whatever new technology or whatever it is that you're working on, the same is true for this. And I believe we need to move diversity and inclusion even out of HR. To me, this is really R&D. This is about future-proofing any business, and we should apply the same level of innovation that we use for our business in general on this issue as well.
Matt, your experience of dealing with people who are uncomfortable around this?
Well, obviously on race, it's not something I've never been disadvantaged as a result of that. And I know, you know, from a white perspective, sometimes discussing these things are hard. And I think part of the problem with the way that we talk about different disadvantages in this country is that it sort of becomes a competition. And I think the real danger at the moment is that people say, well, you know, what about the guy in Doncaster? He's disadvantaged. You know, so why aren't we talking about him? And of course, that's true. But we're all in this together, to borrow a phrase from a time of government you know well. It's not a competition. You know, there isn't a limited amount of fairness and equality and opportunity to go around. And the danger is that people become defensive. Other disadvantaged groups become defensive and say, well, why aren't we talking about my disadvantage? And that's the wrong thing, because we should see this. We all benefit from fairness. We all benefit from, and not just those of us who come from disadvantaged backgrounds, as you said at the start, this is economically advantageous for everyone. So I think people from my backgrounds need to be sometimes less sensitive about talking about other people's disadvantage and not become defensive about our own and desperate to tell our own stories if we've had the same experience as people who are black or from different backgrounds. I think that's really important. I mean, I should say as well, I understand why people recruit people who look and sound like themselves. It feels comfortable. It's kind of easier. But in the end, I think that sort of existence is quite dissatisfying. It's more not only beneficial in a business terms, but it is better to have different voices and faces and lives in the room. It is more satisfying. It makes for a better workplace. So whether it's for the greater good, I think this is, even for your own self-interest, surround yourself with different voices and different experiences, it will be a better place to work.
Okay, that's great. Let's get to the nitty-gritty of this, right? One of the big problems we've got is that lots of people talk about it and they say they want to change things. And over the generations, stuff happens, but we're really acutely aware that not enough has happened so far. So what we bash up against is people saying there should be quotas and you should actively be affirmative and you should be actively going out there and deciding that you are going to choose specifically more diverse people. And then people start getting uncomfortable. In businesses, I know this, they start thinking, oh, well, maybe my chances are less, or is that fair, or what about the law, and that kind of thing. So it starts becoming slightly messier. Ursula, I know you've obviously got strong views on that.
Yeah, I chuckle at the convenience of bringing up as a defense against acting, bringing up the actual life that you've lived to get you to where you are. So to defend, you won't move aggressively in this area because it's not fair, or, you know, it's been lined up for you, or it would be inequitable or whatever the heck it is. But that's how you got where you are. How you got where you are is that literally we've excluded more than 60% of the population in competing for the jobs that you have. We've literally excluded them. Half of the population is women, 25% of the population is brown or black, and I haven't even counted the socioeconomically disadvantaged. So we've picked the leadership of the world from a very, very, very small pool. And what we all we're saying to the leadership of the world, the current leadership of the world, is you have to open it up. And that, based on how you've defined it, based on how white male privilege defined it, is unfair. But if you were to actually redefine the game from all the four of us on this call, it would have never been laid out that way in the first place. So one of the things I say often is that what we're doing now in society, not only because of race, gender, ability, but because of sustainability, because of just the dislocation that we have in the world right now, is we're redefining the game that we're playing, the field that we're playing it on, the rules by which we're playing. We have to redefine that all, because the path that we're, by the way, I don't think we have to burn it down. I think we have to make adjustments in the places. It's just not like throw everything out, we're not gonna have a meritocracy, whatever the heck it is. But we have to actually understand that we got to where we are, not because of fairness, guys. Not because you did it better than everybody else and therefore, no, we did. You got to where we are by power, by brutality often, by laws that were written by you to exclude others. Not you personally, and this is another thing I say all the time. White guys, we are not saying you guys are evil. This is not like, we know that you didn't do this yourself. You were born and raised in the same systems that we were born and raised in. But what we're saying is that since you now are controlling, be a little bit more aware of how difficult it is to just fit in as a black woman, as a differently abled person. You can't contort yourself. We cannot contort ourselves. We've tried to fit into your society as easily. And if we do, people call us spectacular. You're a spectacular person because we've been able to literally bend and, you know, change the way we talk and fit in and kind of be quiet or whatever it is that we have to do. I say, start again. You can do it. You don't have to burn the company down. This is not that. Literally be a look, take, do a plan, just like you have a profit plan, just like you have a safety plan. You're going to have a diversity plan, a diversity and inclusion plan. Write it down. Start working on it. You're going to change it because it's not going to work. You can learn some things. This is a problem that can be solved with smart minds. By the way, we have to change our heart too, but it's a problem that can be solved with smart minds. Let me stop ranting here.
June and Tani are literally applauding. So June, you quickly, and then I'll go to Tani.
What she said, everything she said. I think the thing here is, just what Ursula said, at the end of the day, when it comes to money, we have no problem setting targets. With the stuff that we're serious about, we understand you have to know what it is that success looks like, and you have to have a deadline for when you want to reach it by. So why is it different when it comes to people? And I think that's the argument I always make when we talk about targets and whether or not we should have goals and so on. We have to. If you don't have them, how will you ever know whether or not you've been successful? And then the other thing as well is to understand that actually privilege gives you the luxury of ignorance. And sometimes that ignorance can mean that you are inadvertently complicit to a system that's unfair. So as Ursula said, you didn't create this system. But without question, you are the beneficiary of some of the unfairness that was created by your ancestors. So therefore, you have the opportunity to do things differently so that future generations will be saying, you know what, that generation got it right. So again, it's about your legacy and actually acting to make sure that we create a much fairer system. And in the end, as Matt said, it's economically also the smart thing to do.
Annie.
Thank you. So some things aren't going to work, but actually it's about being brave enough to try and to learn and to think about what you can do better next time. And just because you've tried it before and it doesn't work, it doesn't mean to say it's not going to work now. So one organisation I've worked with, we spent a lot of time talking about, you know, interview process and promotion and all these things. Actually, what it came down to was the graduate recruitment process wasn't fair. And the leader of the organisation at the time said, we're changing it. And it's like, oh yeah, well, we need to have a plan and we need to, like, no, no, we're changing it for this year. And suddenly, you know, the whole system changes. So it's about people being brave enough to say, okay, let's try, and actually not be afraid of it not working. And that's the bit, again, leaders want to be just continuously successful. They don't want anything that sort of associates them with things that aren't working. So actually, I think that the best leaders are the ones who are brave in terms of what they do and just say, okay, let's. And Jean's absolutely right. You know, without a target, we'll never get there. We'll just drift around. And 40 years from now, there might be a few more people. But not reaching the target is different from just not even trying.
Yeah.
So Matt, this is a difficult one. You come from communities like we've seen over the last few years where, you know, Brexit surprised us. You know, people reacted against them, a lot of these things that they weren't comfortable with. We've seen it, you know, in Trump's America, that kind of thing. People aren't necessarily going to swallow this as happily as we all are at the moment. And what do we do about that?
Well, I think with Brexit, it's really important to remember that people from all backgrounds voted to leave and people from all backgrounds voted to remain. And the danger with the debate in the last few years is that leave has been seen as the view of the working class and remain is the view of this sort of almost mythical metropolitan elite. Jacob Rees-Mogg campaigned to leave. Boris Johnson campaigned to leave. Working friends, class friends of mine in Nottingham voted to remain. So I think it's important that we don't say, well, working class people want to leave and we have to leave the EU in order to placate a kind of working class mob. I think something Tani said was really important about graduate training programmes. And actually, I would encourage businesses to employ people and recruit people without degrees, because not only are vocational qualifications important, sometimes people have degrees in things. Let's be honest, some of the dimmest people I met were at university. Like, going to university doesn't prove that you're a better employee. Your degree may not even be relevant in the field you're going into, yet we see it as proof of a particular stature in society. So I'd say consider recruiting people. I mean, I went to university, I never particularly wanted to go and I dropped out, and it's one of my biggest regrets. But I applied for jobs where a degree was mandatory or was desired, and I would just ring them up and say, look, I haven't got a degree, and I ended up getting one of those jobs because I'd bothered to ring them and have a conversation with them. So in a way, it had made me more memorable. So that's something for candidates to do as well, is not sometimes be off, you know, that sometimes the job description isn't sacrosanct, and for people from my sort of backgrounds, it's important to know that. But in terms of employers, be open to people who perhaps didn't go to university for whatever reason. They still may be very good candidates. And something that Ursula said about bending yourself to try and contort yourself in, and obviously, again, as a white man, I don't fully appreciate what that's like, but accent is such a big part, particularly in the UK, of how we judge people. And I'm really self-conscious of the way I sound sometimes, and I'm slightly aware that I've probably softened the way I speak as a result. You know, I worked in the Labour Party, and even that was, at the top levels, a pretty posh place, actually. So I'm aware that I've kind of slightly, and I'm sort of embarrassed that I've done that in a way. And I know that myself, even though I'm kind of like I have a slight inverted snobbery around certain accents, I know that I am more deferential to people who sound posher. There is something kind of hardwired into us that I think we all have to just check ourselves against. And I think if there's any proof that posh people don't necessarily know what they're on about, it is Jacob Rees-Mogg. And I think he is a really important person to remember that you can be really privileged and not very clever and still do very well.
I agree wholeheartedly. I'm going to read out a few quick comments here before I get to another question, just because a lot of people are wanting to just say their comments. Vivian is saying, I agree, equity, diversity and inclusion should not be sat and managed by HR. HR has little experience and understanding of it. There's an anonymous one, my theory, read factual pieces to educate and fiction to flex the empathy muscle, then talk and listen and lose the ego. Imran Hawkins is saying, the feeling of being an outsider is really interesting point. And personally, I felt like this at times in my career. Better business actions are needed. And this brings me to another question, because somebody anonymously has said, is asking about once you're in. So two things I'd like to bring up, and I'll focus this on Ursula and June at top. A lot of the discussion recently has been at board level, when actually it's clear that it needs to be throughout the organisation. And then a lot of discussion about getting people in, but once they're in, what are we doing to actually help them survive in that structure? We know that a lot of people end up leaving businesses because they struggle. So June, let's start with you on that one and then come to Ursula.
Yeah, well, I think it's really important though about culture, isn't it? That's when we look at the second bit of diversity and inclusion, which is the inclusion piece. And actually, is a business even ready to allow and bring in lots of diverse talent? And I do think that you do also need a bit of preparation ahead of time for the staff that you have there already to have these sorts of conversations so that you don't end up with resentment from existing talent and you don't end up with diverse talent feeling that they don't belong and then you have all of the retention issues. So I think you have to deal with this stuff straight away and constantly have these sorts of difficult discussions and create a safe way of doing that. Because if you don't, the talent won't stay, the diverse talent won't stay. If they don't feel like they belong, they'll go somewhere where they do and you know, your loss.
Yeah, I agree with June totally that this is where the inclusion part is. This is what the diversity, equity, the inclusion part is to recognize and develop plans to allow your organization to accept this new body. And it's going to take time. I don't mean take time a long time. I mean, it's going to take time, a short time in action. You have to do it. Second is, it's really important to understand that if you get one of anything, it's odd, right? If you have 100 pink elephants, 99 pink elephants, and you get one gray elephant, everyone is going to notice the gray elephant. And everybody's going to talk about the gray elephant. They're going to focus on it. So if you get one, if we approach this like, oh, we have to get one of these guys and one of these guys and one guy who speaks a little bit differently, they will be on islands all by themselves. So what I say is don't make this a one problem. Make it such that literally you have a number of them, many of them, that you're truly diverse. And then it's not that odd. They have a community. You start to intermingle because there's no other choice. So the second is that this number, this idea that we'll get one and that'll solve our problem. We'll get one of everyone and then we are diverse. That's BS. And then the last, the reason why you start at the board level is because June said it, Tani, if you specify it and measure it, it'll get done. And the boards of companies are the governance structures of these organizations. That's where the governance building. And if they say it's real, if they show by example that they're diverse, and then they say that this is important, the companies have to do it. The CEOs, the C-suite has to do it or else they're just kind of dense. So the reason why you start at the top is because we've tried for hundreds of years to start at the bottom. We've recruited women for years and years and years in engineering and all of this stuff, and we get them in 7 years later. I think the study around the world is consistent. 7 years later, they have gone somewhere else, right? Because we still had a structure that didn't understand what it took to be a woman in the organization. So get some of those people at the C-suite and the governance level. We may have a shot of designing, as I said again, redesigning our society to be more inclusive. It's not inclusive today. It's not going to tweak. We can't tweak it. We're going to have to change it. We don't have to burn it down, but it's not going to be, well, I'll add a guy here, I'll add another guy here, and we've solved the problem.
Okay, a few more comments and then we'll come to Tani and Matt again. Graham Stokes, we've been running workshops which both educate and stimulate by starting conversations, working with Let's Talk About Race. We need to get to a point where people are comfortable about being uncomfortable. It's okay to ask questions as long as we are respectful. Surinder Shan saying, really interesting on class. I notice it when I'm talking to people. I find myself changing my accent slightly as otherwise I feel looked down upon by those with private education. And then, okay, here's a good question for Tani and Matt. What does good look like in an inclusive workplace, putting society to one side for now? What does best look like, Tani?
Sorry, my mute button's been a bit tricky. What good looks like is just seeing a whole lot of different people working in an organization, you know, that when I go into a big building or corporation, that I'm not the only wheelchair user in the building. Or, you know, there are some companies that have played with diversity figures and will say, oh yeah, we've got, you know, lots of representation from, you know, diverse backgrounds. But then when you actually drill down into them, you see that they're working in certain areas, whether it's like the kitchens, the cleaners, the security, middle management. And, you know, I get really frustrated with people who play with figures. They're doing it because they know they're not good. And I think that is a real challenge. So one of the successes of the 2012 Games, and I worked on the bid in the Games, was actually needed to sell tickets. So yeah, you needed to have good venues and competition. You needed to flog tickets because you need people in the stadium. And this came from the top. Paul Dighton, who's now in the Lords, he just said, we need to have a diverse workforce, diverse volunteer and games maker force, because we need to sell tickets to every single person in this country, because we've got a lot of tickets to sell. And when someone like him says it, it just filters all the way through. And I genuinely thought that part of my job with the Games would be to sit there for about 10 years and go, what about the Paralympics? And I never had to do that once, because it came from the top. And so actually what we're able to do with the workforce was a range of people with very varied impairments and intersectionality were employed, so that actually they were not just seen, but were highly skilled. But actually, so it wasn't just everyone with a question on Paralympics coming to me. There was 45 people that they could go to have some of those conversations. And but that is the leader, inspirational leader, who just said, we're going to make this work. And just really quickly, I want to come back to what Matt said about degrees. Really important. I've got a degree in politics. Okay, I work in politics. I was barely asked about my knowledge of politics through various things. I really didn't do British politics in my degree because my head of department thought it was a bit dull. So, yeah, I did German politics the year the wall came down, and I did South African politics the year Mandela walked. Amazing. But actually, when I went to the Lords, you know, I knew stuff. So don't make assumptions, even if you think you've got a relevant degree. Don't make assumptions about what that degree absolutely, you know, actually means.
Okay. We're coming to the end of the call now, and I want to give you all one last question before we finish. Basically, I've been around long enough to have done quite a lot of these diversity panels over the years, and quite often it sometimes feels like we're circling. In a sentence, can you all tell me why you're optimistic that now is a time where there's going to be a lot more change, or things are really changing or not? Matt, let's start with you.
Thanks for that. I think because we're talking about this stuff in a way that we've never talked about it before, and I think there is a genuine will to do it. And it kind of relates back to the last question, but I think so many people join an organization or a workplace and just think, oh, these are the rules of the place. And actually, no one's ever really thought about the rules of the place, because everyone else joined and thought they were the rules. And in life, you make your own rules. And there's nothing more frustrating than thinking, you know what, I wish I'd said that, because someone else might say it and you get frustrated as a result of that, or things don't change. And I think it's incumbent on all of us. And this doesn't just apply to equality and diversity, but just having good ideas and feeling able to pitch them in whatever level of an organization you work at. You make your own rules and be the person who asks the questions, because people won't always presume that you're being confrontational. Actually, it's a really impressive trait for an individual to have. And I feel that individually we're thinking about these things more, and I think collectively we are. Obviously, as a white man, you know, I haven't experienced the prejudice and the all the other terrible things that go along with living in a truly disadvantaged society. So for me, I don't really feel qualified to talk about how hopeful the future really is. But I hope I'm not wrong in thinking that, kind of as a result of the last year, for a number of reasons, I am slightly more optimistic that as a society, there is the desire to do something about it.
Thanks, Matt. June, a sentence of optimism?
Oh, 100%, because I think the question has now moved from why to how. And the fact that we're asking how shows that we're actually ready to do it.
Ursula?
I both Matt and June. I agree 100%, and I'm sure I'm going to agree with Tani when she says what she says as well, because we've been pretty copacetic here. But the other reason why I think it's going to be why we're at an inflection point is that young society is actually involved in this in a way that they've not been before. This is our children saying, you know, they're not, some of our children, you know, your children are not Black, they're not differently able, but they're saying, we want a different world. And they're willing to get out and march and make banners and kind of advocate for change. And I think that wave is going to be hard for us to push back. It's going to be hard for the old guys to push back this wave of young people who are saying, enough is enough. We want a cleaner world. We want a better world. We want a more equitable world. We want it to be different. And I'm very hopeful because of that. And I do have to get over.
Annie, why don't you wrap us up with a sentence on optimism?
So the reason I'm optimistic is I work in an institution that's called the Mother of Parliaments. There's been a building on that site in Westminster since 1079. We currently have a building that's 300 years old and rules that go back 700 years. And we have rules for what colour carpets guests are allowed to stand on at certain times of day. So we have a lot of rules. But during the pandemic, we've gone online. We have online debates. We're doing online voting. We've changed more in 6 months than we have in 700 years. And that comes back to what June said. It's just like, how do we do it? And we're challenging ourselves in a different way. So that's why I feel optimistic that if we can do that in 6 months, what can we do if we bring all these people together to really think about how we're going to make a difference to diversity, inclusion and equality?
Listen, I thought that was amazing. Ursula's just left because she's racing to the airport because she's flying to the UK. But I thought that was really amazing. I learned a lot. It was so inspirational and insightful. So thank you very much to Ursula, to Tani, to Matt, and to June. One of the problems with this is that we can't really show our appreciation by a round of applause. But as usual, I know we'll be doing a virtual standing ovation for what was an amazing panel. And I really hope some good comes out of it. So thank you very much. And we will see you again next week. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye. Pleasure.